I think with any storytelling, it's about the moments. It's about describing those action scenes. It's about answering the question, what did it look like and how did you feel? Over and over again. Like, I think when a story is badly told, it's when it's all commentary, you know. And I think when I look back on stories, like, the things that I want to record are the moments. Like, when we remember our childhood, we don't tend to remember, like, the narrative, big picture. We remember the little moments. We remember sitting in the garden with our friend Monica from up the street with, you know, the little chicks that we bought from the store. Or we remember being in the kitchen with our granny up at the stove, whatever it is. And so I think as long as you include the emotion, then it's going to be engaging. And so I think it's like, focus on the moment, describe a moment, then describe another moment, then describe another moment. That's what I think stories are.
That was Marcia Shandor, and this is episode 13 of the Bobby Jagdev podcast. Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the podcast. Now, before I frame today's conversation, I've got my usual request. If you could do the honors and rate and review the show on whatever merchant distributes this podcast to your device or your computer, that helps me a great deal. And don't forget to hit that subscribe button. I also have a mailing list. And if you sign up to that mailing list, for which there'll be a link in the show notes, you get detailed show notes of every episode directly to your inbox once a new episode is released, so you never miss another episode. And I've had some amazing feedback from the emails that I send out, because it is an easy way of just forwarding on this conversation to friends to enable you to share it. But also, I spend a lot of time in crafting the show notes, not just to frame the conversation, but also to shape the context, to help my listeners understand where some of the lessons and outputs from this conversation can be applied to life, to business, to relationships. And as I said, the feedback has been really encouraging. So what is today's conversation? What is the main event? How am I framing this? This is a conversation on how we best illuminate ourselves in the presence of others, from making new friends or business acquaintances to delivering a sales pitch, performing at a job interview, a keynote, or doing a presentation. In all of these things that we do, either in our personal lives or our business lives, we're somehow, somewhere telling a story. And in fact, when we're attracted to people that are successful or powerful, or they inspire us, it's actually their ability to tell a story. That's the thing that we actually find charming about those individuals. And also, we have limited bandwidth from which we can experience the world. There are certain encounters that there's a really low probability from which we would get the opportunity to do certain things. And the way we get to experience all these things is through stories. From the stories of people that have done these things, we find them captivating. When they're told well, we find them captivating and we live through their stories. And adversely, we then allow other people to live through ours. In fact, as children, we actually learn through stories. But for me, that has always been the real spark of human attraction. It's in the narrative. And that is the frame for today's conversation. In allowing people to live through our stories, we have to be vulnerable. That's how a good story is told, with emotion. And when we're vulnerable, it drives this innate human attraction. And it's from that attraction that relationships and trust are established. Vulnerability is currency, and is the opening gambit to my conversation today with Marcia Shandor. Marcia and I begin today's conversation by asking a question that we actually both hate being asked, and that is to introduce ourselves. As expected, we fumbled. Our anxiety over such a simple question got the best of us, and it always gets the best of me. And it not only provides this comical opener to an immensely fun conversation, but also provides the core foundation in shaping not only an entertaining, but value-filled dialogue. Now, Marsha is a storytelling coach, and in her own words, she helps people fall into platonic business love with you. That's her goal. That's what she does. Marsha's past life covers a whole diversity of accolades, from being a DJ on XFM to producing the music for the E4 hit show, The Inbetweeners, and even Made in Chelsea. She's also a co-author of a book called Off the Mic, The World's Best Stand-Up Comedians Get Serious About Comedy. As a coach, Marsha empowers her clients to tell their stories. But it's not necessarily about the story. It's all about the delivery. And this is where Marsha shines. Now, in 2012, Marsha was scheduled to run the New York Marathon. However, the marathon was postponed due to Hurricane Sandy. And after months of preparation, Marsha wasn't quite ready to hang up those running shoes and not run a marathon that year. So she embarked on an unplanned solo marathon through London, aptly named the Marshathon. Now, this impromptu event involved Marsha literally tying the laces on her running shoes and heading out to conduct this run. There was no thought for any physical logistics, and it was an event that was planned and executed in real time, design as you go. It's amazing what you can achieve once you've not only committed, but you've started the race. The media coverage and the charity fundraising was all shaped as she was running the marathon. And it was this story that sparked a connection between myself and Marsha. And it's a prime example of how stories can captivate, can immerse, can illuminate people, and can drive a connection. The Marshathon ignited a spark, catalyzed a chain reaction of events that connected me and Marsha. And as an output, we have this incredibly engaging conversation between us both. Now, this conversation covers just as much terrain as Marsha's run across London. We share anecdotal stories that have us in fits of laughter. It is a fun-filled exchange. The energy in this conversation is just all-consuming. Marsha is the embodiment of her message, an immensely fun individual with not only a wealth of diverse experience, but she has this gift to captivate an audience. And it's a gift that Marsha is keen to share. Marsha's Russian heritage also helps to remind us how every aspect of our existence is underpinned by storytelling. Historically, stories have not only provided a means of passing down information, but the style of a narrative can also help to shape cultural identities. And we also explore tangential stories and the immense ability a tangential story has in drawing connection. When we share what might feel like a completely irrelevant story, they open us up. We show ourselves being vulnerable. People connect with those things. And it's those tangential stories that, in fact, tell more about us to others than a boring answer to what we do for a living. So, with an aim to help you illuminate yourself, your message, and your best qualities through the power of storytelling, I invite you to join my conversation with Marsha Shandor. Marsha, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I'm going to start this episode off in a rather unconventional way. Because I usually avoid asking people to introduce themselves or mm-hmm. to tell me about themselves. Because mm-hmm. for me, I think part of the beauty of this type of conversation is that I like to shape something that kind of pulls that out of people throughout the conversation.
Yes. I love that. I find it such a boring first question, no offense to anybody who always asks that question. And people aren't very good at answering it a lot of the time. Or they answer it in the same rote way.
I know. But I'm making an exception today, and there's a reason why I'm making that exception, because I stumbled across a blog post by yourself about how do you introduce yourself when somebody asks you, what do you do for a living?
I have a formula.
Okay, so that'll be interesting, because one of the, because I am dreadful at it. Really bad at it. As in, if somebody asks me that question, I will get, it makes me anxious. I get sweaty. I don't know how to respond. And I'll just waffle and I will just bore them senseless and not actually provide any detail or any info around what I actually do for a living. And it's that bad, Marcia, that I think my first episode of this podcast was, what do I do for a living? And I had so many friends actually then ping me back and say, we still don't understand what you do for a living. So,
so when I mostly teach storytelling, but when I teach and communication, but when I sometimes I teach networking. That was kind of my first iteration of my business, was teaching people how to make business friends. And when I talk about answering this question, I put up a slide, and I'm making you a secret webpage, which is going to be yesyesmarcia.com/Bobby, and I'm going to put the slide on, and I'd say there is one question that strikes fear in the heart of even the bravest person. And the slide I put up is of a picture of someone dressed as Santa and then a little girl who just like is like white hot terror in her eyes. And it always gets a big laugh. And then I ask what the question is, and people always know the question is, what do you do? And I don't, like, in my networking teaching, I say, it's such a bad question. Don't ask it. Ask a more interesting question. But you are going to be asked it. And so it is important to have an answer. And so I have a formula, but I always get like sweaty when people ask me, because, you know, the cobbler's children remain unshod and I don't have a brilliant answer for it, but I can try and give you one. Do you want to know the formula first?
Tell me what you do for a living first, and then we'll go through the formula.
Okay. I help people get their ideal clients or collaborators to feel like they already know and love them and want to have anything to do with the person. Oh God, see, I'm not doing a good job.
Marcia,
I help people. Okay, let me try again. Second go. I'm going back to the starting blocks. I help people connect. I just hate the word connect. It makes me feel like I'm a stereo system. I help people, but I'm going to say it anyway. I live in North America. People use it all the time. Let's connect. We should connect. I help people like make a like friendship like connection with their ideal clients and collaborators by telling their own personal stories in a way that is captivating and makes them memorable and liked, so that those clients or collaborators or bosses, whoever it is, wants to do lovely things for them, wants to hire them, wants to help them out, wants to do them favors. Because when you tell stories, people instantly know who you are and if you're their kind of person, and they get along with you. And I also teach storytelling in organizations for leaders, so that they can be a leader who has a legacy, because we tend not to quit a job, we tend to quit our boss. And when we have a boss that we love, we will do anything for that boss. We will go above and beyond. And for people who have to communicate, who are brilliant geniuses who have to communicate with muggles. So whether that's tech people or scientists, they find, I just did a workshop for a big company here in Canada, which is where I live, where it was a bunch of scientists who create the products, and they had to speak to the marketers who then market the products. And the scientists are brilliant geniuses who go and speak to the marketers, and the marketers are like, I don't know what the word viscosity means. And so storytelling is like a Babel fish. You know, if you haven't read or seen Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the Babel fish is a little fish that you stick in your ear that interprets any language. Because if you are speaking to someone and you're saying something, you know, technological, and they're looking at you blankly, but if you instead say, okay, you know, when you sit down at your computer and you know, when you go to click on a new tab and then it throws up this thing, or like you type it in and it's really slow. Imagine if instead you sat down at your computer and it just immediately went to the place you wanted it to. And it felt so much easier and more relieving. And so you're like making this little story for them, and then they're like, oh, now I get it. And so basically I help people get people to fall in platonic business love with you and be a Babel fish.
I like that. I'm going to hold on to that Babel fish analogy. The your formula then?
Yeah, I didn't do my formula very well there. My formula is, and so well, actually, there's two things I'd say before the formula. Mm-hmm. One is 9 times out of 10, when somebody says, what do? Mm-hmm. They don't care. They just can't think of a more interesting question. So like, chill out. I think people get very sweaty about this question, but mostly people do not care. They just aren't imaginative enough to ask something else. And the second thing is, they're not asking, what do you do? And you have to tell me absolutely everything that you do. And if you don't tell me absolutely everything, then I'm going to start yelling liar, liar at the top of my voice. Because so many people do 25 different things.
Yeah.
When I was a radio DJ, I also chose music for TV shows. I was a music supervisor. I also was an A&R finding new bands for a publishing company. Like, who cares? Whoever you're talking to, think about the answer that they're most interested in. And also I would add, like, people don't say, what do you do? And only tell me the things that you do for money, because they're not asking, you know, your Russian immigrant grandmother wants to know what you do for money, but your Bobby loves you anyway. And mostly people don't care. And so if you do a job that is like your silent, I've been talking about this with friends recently, with the jobs that you don't love, you have to think of as your silent investor for doing the things that you do love, as in they pay you for it and they don't care about what you do creatively with it. So maybe you have this passion that you either earn zero money for or not very much for, but you do this other job to fund that passion. Talk about the passion. It's so much more interesting for anyone you're talking to. So with all of those things aside, the basic formula, and it's clunky, so it's a kind of formula you would use, you know, if you were in a networking thing and people were like, everybody talk about yourself for a minute. But it's, I work with demographic, so whoever you work with, who have, excuse me, problem or pain point. I do thing I do in order to get them to thing they really want. So maybe the way I would do that, if it was, say I'm working with somebody who runs a business. So I could say, I work with business owners who are having trouble connecting with potential clients en masse, you know, through their blog posts or their email lists or videos. I help them figure out how to tell personal stories in a captivating and engaging way so that their potential clients will feel like they're already friends, will know, like, and trust them, and will want to buy from them over and over again. That's the formula way of doing it. And the reason that's important is because, and if you're going to drop any of those, which you probably are, the two most important ones are the pain point and the benefit, the pain point, and then the thing you deliver. We think the most important thing is what we do, you know, because that's so interesting to us. But the reason those two things are important is because you want to have an answer to that question that makes someone go, oh, I need to hire you. Or, oh my, I've got to get my sister to talk to you because she was just saying yesterday that she has that problem. Or she was just saying yesterday that she wants that desire. And so I think the only time you want to focus on the doing part is if you know that you're in a room with a bunch of people who are kind of all doing the same kind of thing, so they will be interested. Or if you just don't care about anyone you speak to ever hiring you or wanting to get involved with what you do, which is also fine.
Well, a couple of things actually just to kind of unpack there is, I have that tendency to have to explain everything, you know, thinking that I need, the only way I can add value to answering that question is I have to go through the whole ream of everything that I do. And that's not interesting. And the passion thing is actually quite, I've never really looked at it like that before. And if I reflect on a friend of mine, Duncan, he's an amateur pilot, but he's a tech guy just like me. Now, if he explains to someone, I work in tech, I do what Bobby does, that's just boring. It's just not interesting. But when he opens with, oh, I like to fly planes, that's my hobby, that opens up a whole stream of questions.
Right. You know? But even like, you can answer that I do the tech things, but answer that with passion. Like, talk about, sometimes I do talks for musicians and I say, like, tell me why you care about what you do. Tell me what's exciting about it to you. And I think the other thing is 99 times out of 100, statistic that I'm making up based on a lot of personal experience, people don't answer the question, what do you do? People answer the question, what is your job description on LinkedIn? Like, what is your job title on LinkedIn?
Yeah.
But that's not what you do. You know, even you saying, like, I'm a tech guy, but that's not actually what you do. Like, if you describe what you do and for whom, that's much more interesting to me, because now I can kind of envision it. You know, what's the verb, what it is you're actually doing. So what do you do? If I say that, like, what do you actually do?
So let's move on with the rest of the conversation.
But just tell me, like, what do you do and for whom? and why? Pick the one that you're most excited about. It could be this podcast.
Now we're going to get radio silence. Well, yes. You know, I like making connections. I like meeting new people. I like learning from new people. And I like to add value somewhere. Hmm. I've never explained it like this before. And actually, if we think about the podcast as that example, all the things that I think I've done over time in, you know, in the tech world has kind of found its way into this medium, into developing this platform. So for me, I always like to learn from other people. I always like to put my... Actually, let me reframe. I like to surround myself with super intelligent people that are smarter than me because I know I can learn from those individuals. And I think one thing that I've subconsciously always done in a workplace environment is I'll take on projects that are really, really challenging with people that are way smarter than me. And if I think about this as a platform as well, the guests that I have on the show are all people that I think are, I guess for me, kind of unattainable in regards to some of the conversations that I can have and some of the value I can get from what I can learn. Now I feel like I'm just waffling.
Okay, no, I'm going to condense it down for you afterwards. You're good.
Okay, so, where am I?
Wait, can I already give you your answer?
Yeah.
Okay, so I helped technologists and CEOs in the tech space learn from brilliant geniuses by interviewing them on a podcast and asking them the questions that my listeners wish they could ask so that we all come out of it feeling much smarter.
I like that.
There you go.
And I do. There we go. And that took what? All of like 5 seconds.
but it's also waffling. Like you can't see the label from inside the jar, right? Like that's why I one of the things that I help people do is write sales pages. And so I'm not a copywriter, but I basically work with them to like pull out what is the language that your ideal client is saying when they're bitching to their friends, when they're writing their secret diary, but really when they're freaking the F out at 3 o'clock in the morning. Because when you have that on your sales page, it says to people, I am for you and I'm not for everyone. You know, or this product or this service is for you and it's not for everyone. It says to them, I'm not going to shame you when you come here with this problem. And it says to them, there is a way out. Because clearly I've found a way out and that's why I'm trying to get you to pay me money for it. And it says the most powerful 4 words in the world, which are, you are not alone. Because we all, like, we crave belonging more than anything else, more than happiness. You know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, it's what, like, shelter, food, belonging. And it says that they're not alone because if you've bothered your behind to stick this up on a sales page or an about page or whatever, then you must think that more than one person in the entire world has that. And so what I do is I help people draw out that language that they can use so they can have sales pages and things that will help people even if they don't buy, because first of all, that's nice for a place of service, but also if it's like, wow, you gave me the thing that I crave most in the entire world when I didn't buy, what happens when I actually pay you money? And when I write my own sales pages, or if I get people to ask me these questions, I'm just like, shut up, I don't know, you're not my real dad. Like that's, I hate it so much. It's so hard to do this stuff when it's you. It's so much easier to have somebody. And that's what I so often do when I'm helping, so I help people write keynotes as well. It's so often just like me downloading information from their brain. And then, and it's the same when we do stories, and then I just do what I call Tetris, where I'm like picking it up and putting it together and then presenting it back to them. And people are often like, wow, that sounds so good. And I'm like, yeah, it does. But you couldn't see which bits we needed to get rid of because you're right in the midst of it. Whether it's a story, whether it's a keynote, whether it's a sales page, like it's so much easier to have somebody else be like, okay, this bit, this bit, this bit, we don't need all those other bits. Because we're like, but everything is important. It's me.
Well, you're in the weeds of it. And I know with work, if I use presentations as an example, I've got myself down to this 4-slide rule. If I can't say or present what I need to in those 4 slides, there's just too much content. And when you're in the weeds of it, Marcia, you're right. You think every bit of detail in this presentation is really, really important. And often you can take away from, it takes away from the narrative. As in, I need these slides to say these things, as opposed to thinking, well, actually, I only need one, and then I can talk over the rest of it.
Right, and actually, it's you. So where I learned to edit down, I'm Russian, Which means that I come from a family of people who are all telling stories all day, every day. But I was always the one telling stories where my friends would have their heads in their hands because I put in so much detail that they were like, can you please just get to the point, Marcia? Because I'm like, I was there and there was different colors of grass. There was light green grass and dark green, like the grass didn't matter. And then I became a DJ on music radio. Mm-hmm. And I suddenly had to cut my stories from 20 minutes down to 20 seconds. Because after 20 seconds, the jingle kicks in and you have to stop talking.
So you just get cut off.
Yeah, so you just get cut off. And I started, like, the main bulk of my radio career was at a station called XFM, which was in London and then moved to also Manchester and Scotland. And our first boss, oh God, I loved him. I won't mention him because this sounds bad, but he would just kind of let us talk for like 2-3 minutes. Actually, he did. He would like get me to start to edit down some of my stuff, but then he got fired because it's radio and it's kind of revolving door of bosses. The new boss came in and the higher up said to him, okay, nobody is allowed to talk for longer than 30 seconds. And everybody was wigging out. And I was going, guys, this is going to make us ninjas. Because what was always shocking to me was once I started editing down, the response from the listeners shot up and every word counted. You know, when you're talking to someone and they're kind of rambly, you tend to zone out. You start being like, what am I going to make for dinner tonight? I should get that thing out the freezer, because you know that you can zone out because they're just going to say the same thing three or four slightly different ways. But when every word counts, people hang on your every word. And when it comes to presentations, if you try and stuff in too much, people will zone out. And so what you have to ask yourself, whether it's doing a presentation, whether it's telling a story, whether it's writing a sales page, you have to ask yourself, what is the point I'm trying to make? And do I need to have this in here to make that point? You know, one of the questions I ask when I'm working with people on their keynotes is, if I were to say to you, I'm so sorry, Bobby, I know you thought that your keynote was in 4 months and you were going to have 45 minutes. Actually, it's right now and you have 30 seconds, go. Because that's kind of the core message of like, what do they have to get across? And then we build everything from that. One of the things I always say is like, imagine every word, and this is in copy and in any presentation, imagine every word costs $20. Where can we save some imaginary dollars? So yesterday I worked with a client and in his sales page, he said, well, why is that relevant? I hear you ask. Let me tell you. And I was like, that is a bunch of imaginary dollars. We don't need that sentence. Just tell me why it's relevant. Just go straight into it, because that's not really adding anything to the party. And sometimes it's really hard. And in literature, they call it murdering your darlings, because sometimes you're like, man, that bit's really good. But just save it for another presentation. Save it for the conversation. Save it for the Q&A you have afterwards, because then you'll look like a genius, because people will ask you a question and you'll have this like perfectly formed bit or story.
Well, you know, when you look at cost, there's a cascading effect of cost, because it's not just your time, it's everybody's listening, their time as well. So every word, every slide can end up being expensive. And the point around kind of holding stuff back to engage in the Q&A and conversation, I've made that mistake so many times where I've basically just blurted out everything and I haven't saved anything in my reserves to field that Q&A. And then you feel like you're just repeating yourself and not adding anything new to the question.
And the Q&A is one of the most important parts, because there is a psychological phenomenon known as the recency effect. So there's primacy effect, recency effect. And what it means is we tend to remember the beginning of something and the end of something. And then we kind of extrapolate our entire experience from those two things, regardless of what happened in the middle. So if you end weekly, then, you know, when I work with people on keynotes, one of the things I always have at the end is what I call the call to call. And I used to call it the call to arms, and then the rally cry. I'm trying to make it less weapony. The rally cry, which is the kind of like, are you with me? Because you want to have that at the end, because it's, you know, it's the reason why Bon Jovi plays Living on a Prayer as the last song in the encore, even though that song is 35 years old, because he wants everyone to leave the stadium going, John Bovi,
pumped up.
That was amazing. Can I tell you a story that illustrates that?
Of course.
Okay. So when I was a radio DJ, I used to sometimes do club DJing. And it was indie music, so it wasn't beat matching, but I was pretty good at it. I could work a crowd. And because I knew about the primacy effect and the recency effect, I would always plan my first record and my last three records, because the recency effect is a little stronger than the primacy. So one time I'm DJing at this radio awards show. So if you know, award shows in the UK, pretty boozy affairs. It's free booze. Everybody is either celebrating or commiserating. And everybody I know is there, you know, everybody who looks up to me, all of my peers, all of my heroes. And so there's 400 people on the dance floor. They're all having it. I come on, drop my first record that I've already planned. Big cheer goes up. This can be easy. Over the process of the next half an hour, I proceed to bomb. Every record I put on, more and more people are fleeing the dance floor until there are maybe 10 people left on this 400 strong dance floor. I am being observed by everybody who looks up to me, all of my peers, all of my heroes. It is humiliating. I feel terrible. But then I go to put on my last three records. And I would always choose big hit from the last few months, classic old school banger, slightly unexpected, and whatever the biggest song of the moment was. So I put on big hit from the last few months. This little cheer goes up and about 50 people come back on the dance floor. I'm like, okay, it's a quarter full. This is respectable. Then I go and put on the unexpected classic old school banger and 150 people come back on. So I'm like, okay, the dance floor is half full. This is definitely like much better than it was 5 minutes ago. And then I put on the last record and I would always leave just enough of a gap that people would start a thought but not be able to finish it before the next one comes in. So they'd go, oh, she's forgotten to put on the record. No, she hasn't. And it's this one. So this giant cheer goes up. 200 people come back on the dance floor. Dance floor is full. I'm leaving it in a good state for the next DJ. I feel a lot better than I did halfway through that set. For the rest of the night, and this has happened to me multiple times, it's happened to any DJ you know. For the rest of the night, people came up to me and went, Marsha, your DJ set was amazing. And it wasn't, it stunk. But the first 3 minutes was good and the last 10 minutes was good. And that was all anyone remembered. So if you have a Q&A where you haven't saved anything up, and you haven't thought in advance about the kind of questions you might get and made some notes to practice, then that's what people are going to remember, even if your talk was killer. And so don't be afraid to hold stuff back for the Q&A, and definitely don't be afraid to prepare for the Q&A. And if you can ever have a plant in the audience, that's always good too.
Seed questions.
And seed question, at least one that makes you look smart.
And so the fact that you bombed in the middle of that set, that people
bombed.
Well, okay, so I want to just explore that a little bit. Is if you look at that as a business presentation, there is an air of impacting your credibility partway through. So how how do you balance that?
Because of the recency effect, you just be good. People have very short memories. You know, we see this all the time in pop culture and politics. People have very short memories. And also, people are so affected by their emotions. So it turns out that as humans, I just learned this recently, as humans, we cannot make rational decisions. We are just, our brains aren't able to make rational decisions. What we do is we go to a place called the orbitofrontal cortex, which is sort of just behind, like above our foreheads. And that is where we store memory of emotion. And that's what we consult. Because what we're asking when we make a decision is this going to make me comfortable in the future? Now, sometimes you're making a decision like running a marathon, not very comfortable. But the way I know, you know, when I choose to run a marathon, it's because I know the way I feel afterwards is going to be incredible. And that is going to be feel very comfortable. And that's the memory of emotion I'm tapping into. And so we base all of our decisions on emotions. And so if you can affect people's emotions, I mean, this is why I love storytelling. Storytelling is one of the quickest ways to affect people's emotions. But if you can affect people's emotions, that's what's going to make, if they're making a decision about whether or not you're credible, if you make them feel emotional in that last portion, that's why I talk about the rally cry. That's why I'm like, are you with me? Because then they'll get all like, and they'll get excited and they'll feel, you know, start having oxytocin and dopamine running around their brains. And they will feel emotionally very good. And that is what they'll remember. And so then they'll be, yes, this person is credible. I mean, I think if you're doing a 2 hour presentation and it's a good 1 minute and then a good 3 minutes at the end, that's not going to be enough. But I think if you find that you tank, just be good afterwards. Just make sure the most important parts of your presentation are the first 30 seconds to 2 minutes, because that's when people decide, am I going to listen or am I going to make my face look like I'm listening while I'm actually thinking about my dinner? And then the last part, because that's the bit that people remember the most.
So you can always recover effectively.
I think so, yeah. Unless you do something dreadful. But also name it, you know, if you do, if you do or say something that's dreadful or that's harmful, like name it and then move on. Acknowledge and move on.
Allow it to be buried so then you can move forward.
Although I did just read a thing yesterday that was saying that we he was talking about apologizing and how bad, you know, Brits and settler North Americans are not, it's not really good to apologize in our culture. And one of the things it said, which is super depressing, is that people tend to view politicians who've apologized, they trust them less. You know, which is why if you look at the orange despot currently on his way out, thank goodness, of the United States White House, he doesn't apologize.
No.
Because he thinks it's going to make him look weak. But actually, I think culturally, it's something that we have to try and shift. And I think often we don't apologize because we feel so much shame around, you know, admitting that we're wrong. And so it's much easier to not like to apologize. But I think that's what's ultimately can liberate us.
Absolutely. And I think in some cultures, it can just be looked at as weakness to apologize. It's not just the fact that you're kind of conceding or standing down. Some people look at it as a kind of mark on their personality and credibility by having to apologize.
But I think if you do it well, my first radio job was at Radio 4th in Scotland. And I mean, yeah, radio, as I said, it's very insecure as a career. And generally, they don't say to you, oh, okay, you know, we're letting you go. You've got 2 months left. They usually say to you, oh, that show you just did, that was your last show. But with this one, I switched on the radio one evening to go and I had a show on Sunday night. And I heard, and it was called, mine and the show before were called the Sunday Sessions. And I heard my friends Paula and Scott saying, so we're here, it's the last ever Sunday Sessions. Marsha will be along with the last ever frequency to my phone in the studio. And I was like, did we get sacked? And they were like, oh my God, they didn't tell you. Did they?
So they told you on air.
So I found out after the listeners found out. But I remember going in to see my boss at the time, who was not somebody I felt particularly connected to. And he would just kept being like, well, you know, it had been really hard. We had to tell lots of different people. I'm like, but no one told me. And I was thinking, I just want you to say sorry. And then at the end, he went, an apology. And I was like, just say the word sorry. And I think that people think of it as a mark. But I think if you can do it well, I don't know. I feel like for me, if I have a boss and they do a good job of apologizing, then I will respect them more because I'll trust them more, because I'll be like, oh, you're not going to gaslight me if you do something terrible. And so I can be honest with you. And if you're apologizing, like, I think that when it comes to a lot of leadership, if you can show some kind of vulnerability, then I'm more likely to. So this is what I talk about a lot when I talk about storytelling and leadership, is that storytelling is a super low stakes way to show that you're vulnerable, because all you have to do is tell me how you felt in the moment. Tell me a very small story. Tell me how you felt and make that emotion anything other than great, because everything I do is perfect. Because if you're not vulnerable as a leader, then people will like you less, because we dislike people who we perceive to be perfect. You know, that's why Facebook is so depressing if you're having a bad day, because everyone's just like, I'm amazing. Look at my promotion. My relationship's perfect. And we never have the same stupid fight over and over. And it makes us feel bad. And if your boss is doing the same, it makes you feel bad. You also won't come to your boss when you make a mistake, which is like, if you can bring them mistakes and then they can catch them early. But you also won't innovate, because in order to innovate, you have to be allowed to make mistakes.
Yeah.
And so you have to create a culture where it's okay to not be perfect. And I think that storytelling is a super low stakes way to do that, because you can just tell a story about how you went, you know, stopped off at Starbucks on the way and when instead of asking for a latte, you asked for a smarte, and they, you know, and then you felt like an idiot, but then the barista drew a smiley face next to your.
Well,
I'm not a fan of Starbucks, so I shouldn't be to, when you stopped at your local independent coffee shop and the barista drew a smiley face on your cup, and so then you felt better. And it just shows I am not completely perfect, and so therefore it's okay if you're not completely perfect. But I think, I mean, apologizing is complicated. I found that statistic about politicians depressing, but I think I would respect much more a boss who could own what they did, as long as, you know, you don't have to grovel, you don't have to like wallow, but just to be like, I messed up, here is what I'm going to do differently. And maybe even you use it as a power of strength. You say, I hope that when you mess up, you can bring that to me as well.
Well, vulnerability is currency. And if I screw up, I've learned to hold up my hands and just apologize. Just be very open about the thing that I might have screwed up on. And you're totally right, because it does allow people then to feel as though, actually, I can do the same thing, because Bobby made it okay to apologize and talk about these things. And the bit about innovation is interesting, because if we don't identify what we've done wrong, we can't figure out how to fix it and then move forward. Because all we're doing then is just making the same mistakes over and over again.
Right, right. And you're not trying anything new because it's too scary to make a mistake. Yeah. And so there will be no innovation if you don't have a culture where it's okay to make mistakes.
Absolutely. And I think, yeah, the piece, it is okay to make mistakes. One of the things I say to my children all the time, it's okay to screw up, just be open about it, and then figure out how we kind of move forward from it. Everything's resolvable. Everything is fixable if people, I guess, are transparent and open about discussing it, just working through the mechanics of it.
I mean, some things aren't fixable, I think, but it is still important to work through it.
So I guess it depends on the degree. let's change gears. Okay. And I want to just kind of briefly explore how we connected. And as when I fumbled my Bobby, what do you do for a living question from you, I spoke something about, if I can remember now, about connection and growing my network, making new friends. One of the things that this platform has been amazing for wasn't an intention, it's just something that's developed, is actually making new friends and learning from people. And one of the things that I've really liked is that everybody that's been on the podcast that I didn't know before, I've ended up establishing really good friendships off the back of these types of long form conversations, because they end up being quite intimate. And this is one of the things that I like about audio only, even though we can see each other right now, it only goes out in audio, is there's just something to that spoken word between two people that is over just one frequency. And I've heard you first on the Good Life Project. It's a special episode about the hug. And the reason that was important for me, Marshall, was that during lockdown, Jonathan's podcast is the first conversational podcast I've ever listened to.
Really?
Yeah. Anything before that was music. Kind of like music radio type of stuff. And there was an episode that my wife actually referenced me to, which was an interview with Kumar Ravikant. And it was, I don't know, there was something about that and then Jonathan's work that's just hooked me in to long form conversations. And to have you as someone who's been on his podcast is actually quite momentous for me. So even if you just appeared and said hello and just went away, that would have just made my day. And and that episode where you ran the Marshathon, it stood out for me for a few reasons. And the New York City Marathon was cancelled. You trained for that marathon. And I think you more or less kind of woke up one day and thought, well, screw it, I'm running my own marathon.
I didn't even wake up one day. I immediately was like, I have trained for 5 months, because they didn't cancel it till 36 hours before. It was Hurricane Sandy. It was really hard to get there. We had to like rebook all of our flights. We had to rebook our Airbnb. You know, I don't mean like boohoo, poor us. Like, it was horrible for a lot of people. And I felt kind of compromised also. I was like, it doesn't really feel right that so many resources are going to be going into this marathon. But I also was like, but I've trained for 5 months. I don't want to not do this. And then one of my friends said to me, oh, we should, because I happened to be going to London the week after. And so they were like, we should run a mini marathon when you're here. And I was like, wait a second, what if I just run the London Marathon on my own? And I had emailed everybody I knew to say, you know, sponsor me, but also, do you want to come and cheer me on? Because there aren't going to be. Oh, so the crucial fact is that the London Marathon wasn't happening for another 4 months. So that was why I just decided to do it on my own. And emailed everybody I knew to say, you know, if you want to come cheer me on, that would be really nice. And I honestly thought it was going to be like really solitary. I had a couple of friends who were going to come do mile here, mile there with me, but I had my iPod with me. You know, I really thought it's going to be a very solo pursuit. And I ended up, as I tell in the story, having people running with me the entire way, having strangers turning up. It went viral on Twitter. I was on the front page of the main BBC website, my big picture. And it was like, I mean, one of the best things about it was that it was one of the greatest days of my entire life, but somehow everyone thought I was a hero. It's like the biggest con trick I've ever pulled off in my life. And I had run the marathon 3 years before and just like cried all the way because it was so hard. And I remember getting, I talk about this in the podcast, but I remember getting to the halfway point the first time and they're like, halfway. And I just was like, I can't believe I have to do all of that again. And I found out, you know, like the only thing that got me through this 26.2 miles. And the first time, the only thing that got me through like mile 20 to 26.2 was, you never have to do this again. You never have to do this again. But as soon as I crossed the finish line, I was like, I want to do it again. And then I actually applied that year. I hadn't been running for about a year and a half, but I applied because if you, with the new, I don't know if they still do this, but it used to be if you apply for the new, so you can get in through a charity and you have to raise like a certain amount of money. But if you apply to get in and you don't get in, I think you can apply three times and then you automatically get in the fourth time. And so I'd only been running again for like 6 weeks, but I was like, oh, I've already applied once straight after the last one, didn't get in. I'll do it again. And then that means I can do it next year or the year after. And then I got an email saying, you have got in. And I was like, oh no, now I have to do it. But yeah, it was a really fun thing. So Jonathan then put together this special. So as you said, it's usually long form interviews, but he put together a special episode, these two special episodes called The Hug, where he got people to tell uplifting stories. And so I offered to tell that one. It was really fun. It was so nice to story. So what happens in your brain when you're listening to a well-told story or telling it is that your brain thinks the story is happening to you. And so whenever I tell the Marshathon story, I get to do the Marshathon again. It's so great.
Well, I felt like I was doing it. So it's awesome.
And that's what happens. I mean, that's the magic of storytelling. It's so powerful that when I tell it, literally, like, they've done studies where they look at people's brains in MRI. If we'd looked at your brain when you were listening to that story, the parts of your brain that were lighting up would have been the parts of your brain that would have been lighting up if you were actually running the marathon. So, you know, I'm trying to think what, like, I talked about. But I talked about like somebody handing me a bottle of Gatorade, you know, grabbing it with my hand, then the parts of your brain that would have lit up there was your motor cortex, specifically the part related to hand movement. And so it is really, you know, that's I always used to talk about how when somebody's telling a story in a room and everybody's listening, whether it's three people or 3,000 people, there's a kind of energy and alchemy in the room. And I realized it's not alchemy, it's neurology. It's everybody's brains all lighting up in the same place at the same time, like a giant benign alien invasion. But it's powerful, and we feel that, you know, we've all had that experience. And so it was really, I loved going on that podcast. I was so thrilled when you got in touch. It was really nice. Like, the response I've had from it has been really, really lovely.
And I think that's what's so awesome is that, you know, I remember I kind of emailed you and you replied back within hours, and it was just amazing to make that connection. And now that we're here having this conversation, and one of the things that was going through my mind whilst I was listening to it was, it was only about 18, 20 minutes long, I think.
And 10.
10. Oh dear. I felt like I'd been listening for an hour. And I mean that in a good way, honestly.
That's very moving. Thank you.
And the reason is because you only gave enough to then allow my mind to then be creative and trigger a whole load of emotions that then started to build the rest of the story around it. And the fact that you're telling me now it's only 10 minutes long, I'm really, you know, I'm not sure what happened, because I actually go for a walk while I listen to most of my podcasts, and it's an hour's walk, so I wonder what happened to the rest of the walk. And
so just in a reverie,
I know. And it's but yeah, you, the way you told the story, you allowed my mind to just be creative around it, to start to fill in some of the gaps the way I'd want to fill in those gaps. And a couple of characters, I mean, some subplots started to appear, and even two characters. And I think I remember mentioning this to you in the email, was, you know, there's you running, and I had a picture of Forrest Gump on one side and then Rocky on the other side, because naturally that's where my mind goes when it's something to do with running. So I just want to unpack that around, how do you kind of hold back on some elements, and using that story as an example, to allow my mind to just go into that space?
So I think it's, again about being like, what do I need to get across? Like, what am I trying to get across, and what must I have in there? Like, it was, so for those of you who haven't, if you haven't heard it, I'm a very slow runner, and I was even slower because I kept stopping and chatting to the people who came to cheer me on, because there wasn't anyone else for them to see. And so I think, like, at the first marathon I ran in 6 hours, I think that one it was like maybe 8 hours. I accidentally ran 28 miles, which is technically an ultra marathon. My GPS watch died halfway through, but we kind of figured out from other, you know, piecing together other people's how far we'd run and how far I'd run. And And so lots of different things happened. I mean, that story, it was maybe 12 minutes, but it was not 8 hours long. And so when you're telling a story, it's like, what am I pulling out? Like lots of other things happened that I had to cut out. And also characters, you want to cut out extraneous characters. I have a whole video about this, which I'll put on the secret webpage, yesyesmarsha.com/Bobby. So when you're telling a story, you're making a movie inside your listener's brain. And so if you think about movies, most movies that cover any, like most movies aren't about a period of time that was an hour and a half long. You know, every now and then they are, but mostly they're not. Mostly they're over months or years. And so what they do is they kind of pick action scenes and then just, you know, it's like, what action scenes do we need to have to get the story across? And then the rest, either we just don't have them at all. Like you don't, it doesn't show a montage of people sleeping every single night in the movie. Or you have voiceover montage from time to time to describe that passage of time. And so it's the same with stories, is you're always asking, like, what action scenes do I need to have in there? And that story, actually, the first time I ever told it on stage was 7 years ago. I went to the World Domination Summit in Portland, which is a big conference, and they asked for people to pitch stories. What they wanted was an inspirational story that you could tell in 90 seconds. And I was like, what have I ever done that's inspirational? I was like, oh, I guess that marathon, someone might think that was inspirational. So I told that story in 90 seconds. So as you can imagine, I had to cut out most of the detail that you heard.
So it's a super condensed version.
But again, it wasn't that I didn't put in everything that you heard. I didn't say, then I was there, and then there was a person, and then there was the bridge, and then there was this. I just picked one or two or three elements and gave those little tiny action scenes and then told it in 90 seconds. And I really wanted to, you know, there's a whole bit, I guess I won't put a spoiler because I'll link to it in the secret webpage, but there's a point where something bad happens. And I really wanted to put that in the 90 second version. I tried so many different ways, but I just couldn't. It just would have taken up the whole 90 seconds. So I wouldn't have been able to explain anything else. And so it had to go. But like I said, when you cut it out, you find another place for it. I got to put it in that GLP story, you know? And so you can always condense things down. And when I run workshops, I do an exercise where I get somebody to tell a 2-minute story, and then we get them to tell it again in 30 seconds, and we get them to tell it again in 10 seconds, which is like an old improv game. But usually I say at the end, if I'd asked you at the beginning, could you have told that story in 10 seconds? And they say, no way. But actually you can, you know, it's a better version usually when it's 20 seconds, two minutes or 30 seconds, but you can usually edit stuff down. So again, and sometimes I think people go too far the other way because they don't want to bother people. And I think that also is a disservice. If someone says to you like, oh my gosh, how did the interview go? And if you're okay. It's okay. It's like, what does that mean? So give us something.
Just find the right balance.
Yeah. But I think the right balance, and again, the right balance depends on who your audience is. When you're sitting down with your best friend, you can tell a story that's an hour long. When you're on music radio, you've got 20 to 40 seconds. Mm. And so think about who your audience is and what they're, you know, if you're doing a keynote to a bunch of self-development people, you can tell a nice, long, juicy story. If you're doing a presentation to the board of directors, you first need to say, okay, today I'm going to talk about this thing you care about and other thing you care about, and then slight intriguing thing that's going to make you want to listen, but first a quick story, and then you make it quick.
I think what that draws to me is that we speak about connection, and we spoke about this at the beginning of the podcast around me using this as a vehicle, or using some of the skills that I think I've hopefully acquired over time to kind of develop this. So the networking, connecting with new people, and the kind of art of conversation. So I'm always a good conversationalist. I end up being a slightly verbose, I know that, and that's something I'm working on. Is that if I look at how I try and make connections with people, I try and find a story or something. And sometimes those stories I found are more interesting when they're not what somebody's expecting. So if I use an example of this podcast, if I'm sourcing new guests, I'm trying to make new connections, I try and find something that we can connect on, even if it's not related, that can surprise someone. And that's something I've always found useful in the world of business as well, is a random point something that might have happened to me on the way to work, or maybe something at the weekend that may not even be related to the thing that we're supposed to be discussing, because immediately it just kind of strikes an interest. And I've always found that quite effective.
Yeah, it's a pattern at rest. I mean, when I'm working with people on keynotes, that's what I always talk about, is that the story doesn't have to directly relate to the subject. And that often when we have these tangential stories, like when I talked about the primacy recency effect, I was talking in terms of presentations, but then I told you this whole story about being a DJ and, you know, potentially humiliating myself in front of my heroes. You then imagine that dance floor in your head and imagine, you know, my like emotional roller coaster of being humiliated and then feeling respectable and then being excited. And it's much more likely to stick in your brain than if I just told you a story about a time I did a presentation and made the beginning and the end good or bad. And so, yeah, I love, you know, and I think any, and I think when it comes to presentations, pattern arrests don't always have to be stories. I have one client who came out singing a Beatles song and got everybody, 600 healthcare workers, to sing with her. But just anything surprising. But I think, you know, anything that isn't just today, we're going to talk about this, this, and this.
People just tune out.
And this, this, and this. Point number one. You know, but I think those little tangential stories are always much more interesting. And they tell us so much more about you as well. I mean, I think that's the other thing I love about storytelling, is it really tells someone who you are. Like, we've all had that experience of listening to someone tell a story and like it's perfectly told and they're hitting all of the beats. We think, wow, that is a great story. I never want to be friends with you. You know, we've all like been to an event, usually when we're standing around awkwardly, and then somebody tells a story and you're like, I love you, new best friend. And so I think those little stories of little moments really tell us who you are. And I think that's the other thing, is people often think vulnerability means having to say, oh gosh, and then when I was going through my divorce and it was terrible and I was so depressed. It doesn't. You know, I just did a presentation to the entire executive team of one of the biggest corporate companies in Canada. And I started off with a story about me looking at this plant and feeling like a loser because I knew I needed to repot it, and I kill plants all the time and I'm trying to water it and I'm having to like prise up the leaves to get the water in, and then when I finally go to repot it, I see there's a plastic rod in the middle of it. This is 6 months later, and then it turns out the entire plant is plastic. And like, that's got nothing to do with storytelling, but it also like has nothing to do with, that doesn't make me any less of a good storytelling and speaker coach, because I A, kill plants, and B, literally almost ruined this plastic plant. There's still water in the bottom of it. Ruined this plastic plant by trying to water it when it's made of plastic. But it tells you a lot about who I am, and it you know, and then was an example that I could throw back to.
Well, and you know, that the thing about making connections is obviously trust is a key I don't think it's necessarily an output, but trust is a key component to establish new connections and have that develop. 100%. And one of the things that I've kind of learned about myself is I always thought people have got to earn my trust. I realize that's not actually true. And when I reflect on that, it feels more as though I actually put everybody on the same level. So everybody's got my trust from the outset. And then the more that you learn about people, and as they start to kind of evolve or devolve personal stories, and you start to work alongside people, that the trust gauge then starts to move. So everybody starts at the top. And if, you know, somebody's personality or the things that are happening or the things they're telling you, if it's not aligned maybe to my values or the things that's good with me, that gauge starts to fall. And that's one of the concepts that I now have when I meet new people.
I mean, I think also there's a big thing around trust and vulnerability. Brené Brown talks about how when we meet someone, vulnerability is the last thing we want to show them, but it's the first thing we look for. And the people who I feel mistrustful of in my life, you know, there's not that, luckily, not that many of them, but it's often people who just, how's it going? Oh, so great. So great. Just got a promotion at work. Relationship has never been better. My kids do everything I ask them to. Just brilliant. I'm just like, but is it? I don't believe them. And it makes me feel insecure because I think on some level, I deeply dislike very few people who I personally know. Obviously, there's orange despots, who I have strong feelings about, and blonde despots in the motherland. But in terms of people in my day-to-day life, I tend to find it pretty easy to like people. But there's two or three people who I see at conferences who, when I see them, I'm like, oh, you're the worst. And I like inspected that, because I don't like that feeling. And I realized it's because they never show a lick of vulnerability. And I think on some level, I think maybe you are perfect and you're going to judge me because I'm not. Like, I think that's what's going on.
Yeah, no, that's quite interesting. It's true. It is. I think when we seek that vulnerability out from people, it makes us feel better, because it feels as though everybody's human. Everybody in some shape or form is either having a bad day or...
And it means you're not going to judge me. Like, when I'll often go to conferences and I'm speaking or I'm presenting and I'm always having fun then. But if I go to a conference as an attendee and I don't know anyone, my overwhelming emotional response is that I hate everybody. Mm. And I think this is a very British thing. I think it's like, I'm going to hate you first. And then if you judge me and find me not good enough, it doesn't matter because I already hate you. Remember going to one... It's Michael Port's Heroic Public Speaking. And a friend of mine got me a ticket and I was like, oh, this will be helpful and maybe I'll get some potential clients. I mean, it was amazing. It was a great conference. But I got in, I'm a bit late, so I'm sweaty. I'm always convinced everyone's going to think I'm a dirtbag because I don't, you know, I turn up in a dress, but like, is it not smart enough? And I sat next to this guy and he was wearing a business suit and I was so angry with him. Who has a business suit to a conference? So mad at him. And then... we started talking in the break and that, I didn't open with that question, but you know, when I was like, oh, you know, have you been here before and how's your week? And that's the question I asked. He's like, how's your week been? Do you do anything you like? And as I'm talking, it turned out, surprise, surprise, he's not a perfect robot. And so then I stopped being mad and I was like, oh, maybe you just didn't know what to wear and a suit is like a really good answer.
So you feel bad
for
him.
Aren't going to judge you. So you think. And but I think that's also a thing around vulnerability, is it's like feeling vulnerable. And so if you can be cynical and judgy about everyone else, it's like an armor between you and them. So it doesn't matter if they judge you because you already hate them.
And, you know, one of the things that gets me in those scenarios when it comes to meeting new people is names. And so two things. Firstly, I struggle in remembering names, but I find it really important because I've always been very particular about ensuring that I call people by their name and also that I pronounce their names properly. So as I've got more confident, I think, in myself, I'm happy to ask people, how do I pronounce your name? Because I want to pronounce it correctly.
It's essential.
It is. And, yeah. And especially, and I know myself, because my name is Bobby, but that's not my real name. And people will butcher my real name. So my real name is Baljinder. It's not said like that. So in Punjabi, it said Baljinder. But I've been called so many things as a kind of deviation of that name, which is where I don't have an association with it. So I make a particular effort to ensure that I pronounce names properly. But Marsha, often somebody's told me their name and it's just gone and I can't remember it. And then the worst thing is that months can go by and I still don't know their name. So if I knew somebody at the gym, as an example, they're always calling my name and I don't know what their name is. And I thought about some methods around how can I figure out what this person's name is without asking them? Because that gets embarrassing after like 2 or 3 months. You can't ask. And it's things like, what's your email address? And then they give you some random email address, like, you know.
It's like,
that doesn't help. Damn it. What can I do? But so that happens to me a lot where I've missed the moment.
Do you want me to tell you a trick for that?
Yes.
This was like how I got people to sign up to my mailing list when I taught networking. I have a whole thing. I have a whole video about this, Bobby. I'm going to link to it on the secret webpage, but I'm also just going to tell you right now. Okay. So first of all, when you're being introduced to someone, it's kind of a stressful situation. Like you're trying to coordinate, you know, pre-COVID, coordinate shaking hands, now coordinate.
Or it could be several people as well. That's the other thing. So you're bombarded with.
Yeah, right. You're trying to like make sure that you're making eye contact. You're trying to make sure you don't fluff up your name. And so 9 times out of 10, when I'm introduced to someone, they may as well just be saying la, 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 like it doesn't go in. So first of all, and when you're bad at remembering names, there's a lot of shame around that. And so we think that it's not okay to say, I'm so sorry, what's your name again? I think in any one interaction, you can ask people 3 times before it becomes awkward. So that's the first thing. And I think for the people that you've known for months, I've also done that too, where like, I've now learned to say, I'm so sorry, I'm having a total brain fart. Can you remind me of your name? Because also that just happens to me all the time. I just forget things and words. And most of the time when somebody says, if somebody says that to you, you're not like, how dare you? Usually you're like, thank you for caring enough to want to know. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, and this is a thing I learned from Darren Brown. It's got a great book called Tricks of the Mind, which if you are listening and you don't know Darren Brown, he is amazing. He's like a magician. He's like a David Blaine with a sense of humor and self-deprecation.
And expression.
David Blaine, who doesn't take himself very seriously. And anyway, he has this great book called Tricks of the Mind. And he taught me this trick, which is you create a strong visual image that is something kind of ridiculous and different from the person. So say I meet you, Bobby. The first person I think of is Bobby Brown. And so what I have to do is imagine you dressed up as Bobby Brown, but like really badly. So maybe that like little kind of flat hat he had for a while, and then like a big, really big shoulder pad, blazer, and then like doing the Bobby Brown dance, girl, think about it before, like that's blasting. But like, you're like,
have you seen my closet? Cause I've got the flat caps.
Anyway, so I have to imagine you dressed as Bobby Brown, or if it's a name like Baljinda, is that right? Okay. Then it's like you've got to break it down and be like, okay, so, and this is hard to do when it's actually, but so if I had to break that down, like there's a kind of, to me, it sounds like there's a, I don't know how you write it, but like there's a kind of half pronounced L in there.
Yeah.
And so maybe I'd imagine like, and then, so what, let's see, Baljinda.
This is why I don't use a name.
Okay, so maybe I'd imagine like a bull, you with like bull's horns, swigging from a bottle of gin, and then looking at me and going, duh. I'm like, don't you know my name? Duh. And so then I'm like putting those three together, but I'm trying to make them like interact with each other. So like, there you go. Right, it's kind of bad.
That's a pretty cool visual. I never looked at it like that before. So now if I have a coat of arms, I think that's what it would be.
Right. So you do that. And so it's, but if you talk to someone, you know, say you meet someone called Marsha and you have a friend called Marsha and she looks a lot like me, you have to make it very different. So maybe your friend Marsha has two cats. So you just imagine me with like cats draped over my face. The more insulting you can make,
they stay
this
in
visual,
your mind,
the better, the more ridiculous. So that's the really, that's the powerful thing. But what I found, so that was the thing that I learned from Darren Brown, but what I found was I'd be introduced to people and then I'd be fixing this visual in. So I would look at them for like a fraction longer than usually look at someone. And then I would see them like in their eyes and being like, oh, Marsha is into me. Because that's usually the reason you like hold eye contact with someone before you move away. So I've learned that you have to ask a question to give you the time to fix that image in. So ask a question about something you don't care about, like how did you get here, or you know, how do you know, blah blah, and then that will give you the time. And then the next thing is repeat it at least once, and you might have heard that before, but you need the visual first. That's the most important thing. And then repeating it, so you can just be like, how did you get here, Bobby, or you know, nice to meet you, Bobby, and it will feel weird to you, but it won't to them, because people love the sound of their own name. And then the final step is review whenever you can. So when you are going to the bar to get a drink, look around the room and be like, Stephen, Baljinda, you know, Yusuf, Emma, whatever. Which if you're bad at remembering names, you feel like a winner doing that. You're like, Stephen. And when I first learned this trick, it was a summer that I happened to go to a bunch of weddings where I didn't really know anyone. And I would remember 80 people's names. But you have to do the reviewing. And if it's in a networking event, they give you a business card, write on the business card what your visual is for them, because that will help. That will help you. Because I went to a reunion for that wedding 6 months later and I couldn't tell you anybody's name. But I think there's also sneaky ways that you can, you know, all of my friends know that if I say, this is my thing, this is the thing I do, is I introduce them to someone else, somebody else who I know they haven't met. And I'll be like, oh, have you met Maya? and knowing that they haven't, and then I stand back and watch them introduce themselves to each other, and then I get to hear their name. You know, all prime friends. All my friends know that if I ever don't actually tell you somebody's name, it's because I've forgotten and I need you to step in. So I'll just be like, oh, have you two met? And then just step back.
Ah, yeah.
And let it happen.
Yeah, and you know that replay? I guess there's two methods there of replay. It's just kind of etching that into that memory cell. So it stays in there. And one of the things that I now do, and I saw somebody else do, was in a meeting room, and there were 10 new people across the table. And I was, not that I look over people's shoulders in a meeting room, but he drew a picture of a table on his notepad. And I thought, he's just going to start doodling. He's just bored already. And then as everybody started to announce themselves, or, you know, their names, he started writing down the names in the order that they ran table. And I was thinking, that's a genius idea, because I always struggle in those situations to, especially when it's 10 new names, you're not going to remember the 10. And he instantly just had this cheat sheet of names.
I do it always. And I write down what they said as well, if they tell me any details about themselves. Because you can also, once you start doing this trick, you can use it to remember people's jobs, people's pet names, their spouses' names, their kids' names. Mm. Like, if somebody has a kid or a pet, as far as they're concerned, that kid or that pet is the center of the universe. So when you say, how is little, you know, Semha doing? Then they'll be like, well, of course you know her name. She's perfect. She's everything. And it makes people feel really good.
It does. It
makes people feel special.
What about when, and I've done this before as well, is when you haven't corrected people on your name. So I have, I remember once, maybe more than once, but this one sticks in my mind. I introduced myself to somebody and he called me Billy instead of Bobby. Mm. And I thought, well, I'm never going to see this person again. So I, there's just no point in correcting him. So 3 years go by. And I see this person all the time, and he continues to call me Billy. And then even other people start picking up on it. Why does he call you Billy? And I kind of explain, well, it's too awkward now to correct him.
This is a truly British problem. I have the same. People call me Martha all the time, and they quite often do it. And I just don't bother. I just feel too awkward to correct them. And I feel like, I don't know, it's funny. There's also, like, I think there's a North American British thing where I feel like North Americans are very, you have to call them by their full name. So they might be called like Rosalind Lee, Roseanne Lee. And if they lived in the UK, they would just start getting called Rosie. Like, that would just happen. They have no choice. But I feel like here people are like Roseanne Lee. And I'm always like, it's too many syllables. You got to pull it back. But people here are kind of really obsessive about getting it right. And yeah, I think you just have to power through the awkwardness. I mean, I think often we think those moments are going to be more, you know, we're so desperate not to feel awkward. You know, when this came up for me was I didn't come out till quite late in life. And so lots of people knew that I'd had relationships with men, but they didn't know that I was queer and that I have relationships with both. And so, and at first I just didn't say anything, and it was because I couldn't handle the awkward moment of when I would say my girlfriend and they would be like, because I know they'd stop listening to anything that I say, because they'd just start being like, oh gosh, yeah, she did have short hair for a really long time. You know, because that was what I would do when somebody said to me my boyfriend, I'd be like, oh yeah, snappy dresser, likes dance music. You know, like these terrible cliches, whatever. Some of which are true, many of which are not universal, most of which are not universal. But actually, in retrospect, I think I just wasn't willing to... I used to say, oh, I don't want people to stop listening to me. I just wanted to listen to what I'm saying. But I just wasn't happy to have that awkward moment. And I feel bad. Like, it was also probably internalized homophobia, and I've like since somewhat publicly apologized to my early girlfriends. And so now I have this... And I present as straight to a lot of straight people, and so now I will be like, blah blah blah, my girlfriend, blah blah blah, you know, my partner, she, and I feel this moment where everyone's like, eh, and they're in their heads being like, wait, and in my head, like, when I see it coming, I'm kind of internally, I'm like putting my hands on their shoulders being like, guys, about to mention that I have a girlfriend, like, it's gonna be a moment, we're gonna get through this together. And then we get through it and then it's fine. Mm. And so I think in the same way, I think you can have a bit of being like, and you can be nice about it. It's only awkward if you're like, actually it's Bobby. You've been calling me Billy for years. Of just being, putting your hand on your chest and being like, It's actually Bobby. I'd be like, I love that you call me Billy. It's actually Bobby. I'd be like, I love that you call me Martha. I have great associations with that name. It's actually Marcia. And this, as I'm saying that, I'm such an extroverted thinker because as I'm saying this, I'm like, good point, Marcia. Well, this is what you can do next time it happens.
I guess that, you know, the deferment creates more anxiety, doesn't it? In both of those scenarios.
Right. You know. Totally.
And then the worst thing is, and I'm just about to call you Martha now that you mentioned it.
The worst thing is, Mauritius.
Is when I share the Billy Bobby story, people find it funny and then they start calling me Billy. Yeah. So now I have a pool of people call me Billy as well. So now it's just had this cascading effect.
Nice.
So this kind of feels like it brings us on to listening, which is where I wanted to kind of move us forward to, which is just a nice segue because a lot of these, I guess these anecdotes that we've shared have a lot to do with listening, as in not listening. And I like to do a lot of research on my guests, and I stumbled across your blog and I got immersed in your blog. Marcia, I have so many notes of things we're just not going to be able to cover.
Aww.
And I spent hours just reading a lot of the articles, and so many stuck in my mind, but the one I want to kind of unpack with you now is around the three modes of listening. And an episode that's coming out in a week's time is with an amazing person called Nicole, and she's a conflict and mediation expert. And one of the conversations we have, and we only scratch the surface on this, is around active listening. Now, we don't unpack it to the level of detail that I know you did, and I'm hoping to do now, around the three levels. And one of the things that I've noticed a lot of, and I've done this in the podcast and I do this in presentations often, is if I ask a really, really good question, I can get a response from somebody else to say, Bobby, that was a really, really good question. What happens is that my mind then goes into self-congratulation.
High five, yeah. Me!
And while I'm doing that...
podcasting.
And then while I'm self-congratulating myself on that question, I'm not listening to the answer.
You need to like practice an internal high five. It's just like
just quick and then okay, focus. Done.
Yeah. Or just be like, save that for later. Just put it in the corner of the room. After the podcast, you can just go and be
exactly,
like,
exactly, I can write it down.
Rub it all over your face.
So let's explore level one first, and we'll walk through the other levels.
Okay. So I have to tell you that I learned these three levels of listening, and this is a deep cut in the blog, by the way. I'm impressed. I learned the three levels of listening from my, I will stick his website on our secret webpage. Aaron Handelsman is a friend of mine, a dear friend of mine, who is a brilliant life coach based in Detroit. And he taught me this and it blew my mind. So level one is what, like those conversations where you're just taking it in turns to speak and you're like truly not really interested in each other. Level two is the one I'm really good at. Level two is where you're genuinely listening, but then somebody says something and you're like, oh, I have a thing about this. Oh, I have a thing about this. When you finished, I can tell you my thing about this. That's the thing that I excel at. And level three is where you're just really deeply listening and you're not going off on your own little like I have a thing or I need to high five myself, and where you start to notice other things. And so Aaron is someone who's really good at this, that, you know, I'll be talking to him and, you know, he might say like, you seem tense, or like, you just said that you're okay with that thing, but you're not, are you? And I'll just burst into floods of tears. And so those are the three levels of listening, but I really learned about them from him. I think most like life coaches I know are good at this. Good life coaches are good at doing level three listening and kind of listening for what's there and also listening for what's not there. I think the one time I'm good at doing level three listening is when I'm coaching someone on a story. So as well as coaching people on keynotes, I run a storytelling show called True Stories Told Live, which was in person, is now online. And I coach the storytellers for that, and we'll often spend like one to 3 hours just going deep on one moment in their life. And often people come with what they think is the story, and then I dig around and we're like, oh no, this is the story. And we like pull out all this much deeper, more exciting stuff. Or people come with like an entire summer and I'm plucking out one moment. I'm always trying to find the, you know, what's the human relatable moment within that. And that is when I feel like I'm deeply listening. And it's such a magical experience. Like I feel so lucky that I get to do it and get to like, it's all this coachy language that people in my online world use that I try not to, but people talk about holding space and it always used to make me want to throw up, people say that phrase, but now I get it, that it's just like just being there and listening. And there's sometimes when I'm doing that process of the story coaching where I'll often kind of redirect people if I feel like we're going off on a tangent, but sometimes I'm like, you know what, this person just really needs to tell me this right now. And so I just will sit and listen, and it feels very profound. Like almost always I and the other person come out of those sessions kind of high on endorphins and like oxytocin flooding around our brain. And I've got to like hear the director's cut of the story. So I get to, you know, go really deep. And some of these like amazing stories of like running face first into a bear or going and being part of a sort of somewhat benign cult or going to prison unlawfully for the weekend, like all these things that I don't want to do, but it's, I feel like I have an experience of what it was like to do them. And also for me, I'm a white, cis, non-disabled lady who, as I said, often is read as straight. And so I don't have experience of so many things if I were not, you know, did not have all of those privileges. But through storytelling, I feel like I get to touch those. We just had a storyteller called Jeff Harry tell a story. And again, he wanted to come with something fun and light about him being in high school. And then we actually got to this really deep part of him. He was going to a party and they suddenly like they so stuttery when I'm talking about this, because not like I'll link to it. It's not really, you know, it's somebody else's story to tell, but he basically had, they were super racist about him and he had to kind of lie about who he was. And it was really awful. And I'm never going to know what that's like because I'm white. Like I'm never going to experience that. But I, through tapping into the emotions, this is why emotion is the most important part in storytelling, because you can relate. Because when we talked about the emotion he felt of like the fear at hearing what he heard and the like horror and the kind of disappointment and the shame that came around it, and you know, with him in the story that he kind of pretends that he's somebody else, and then there's like shame that comes in that and disappointment and all of this, and all of those were things that I could relate to. And so I think that's the other reason I love doing level three listening and storytelling, and why I think it's so wonderful to just sometimes just sit and listen to someone tell you a story, is you get to have these experiences that you otherwise would never have. You get to like have these understandings that otherwise you would never ever get to have.
You live through the emotions, and I've always been conscious about listening and acknowledging that I've actually listened to the thing that person's saying, but I've never always been cognizant of the other things that are happening around what I should be listening to. And some of those are the signs, their body language. What is my body language giving off to them? And I guess other emotions that are coming out from that conversation. And again, even if somebody's telling a story, how are other people then receiving that story as well? Because they're all signs, they're all bits of data that can then help you process what's really being delivered from that conversation.
And even like an example is, now we're all on Zoom. You know, if you've ever had a Zoom meeting with someone on an iPad, it's so annoying because they're just looking down at the bottom. They're just looking, you know, it seems like they're looking at your left shoulder the whole time, and it feels pretty hard to have a conversation with them. What I always teach people is that you want to think about the camera as the person's eye and their face on the screen as a giant zit on their cheek. Like, you're allowed to flick your eyes down once or twice, but really you've got to keep your eyes on their eyes. And so the whole time, you know, when you're talking, whenever I'm trying to do deep listening with someone on, or any kind of listening on Zoom, I'm trying as much as possible to just be looking at the camera and not be looking at your screen below. And so it means that I don't get the experience of having you, but I'm hoping it makes a big difference to how heard you feel and how connected you feel.
Interesting. I can see that now, actually. I'm looking at my camera.
So you're doing it now. But that's as a podcaster, as an interviewer, that's my hot. I mean, there's so many things. I used to do a podcast where I interviewed comedians about what it means to be a stand-up comedian. And we had a book come out, me and Deborah Frances White, called Off the Mic. So if you're interested in the mechanics of stand-up comedians, then look that up. But the podcast I did was long, it was just called Marsha Meets. But it was long form interviews with stand-up comedians. And so it would be like 45 minutes and we'd get really deep in. And I realized that I always had to have somebody else in the room, because if I just laughed, it sounded weirdly sycophantic. This is when I was on the radio that I was making them, so I was in the radio studio. But if I had somebody else in the background laughing, like the comedian, if I didn't laugh, the comedians would be freaked. And so there's so many things that I learned in that. And like one of the things I learned is not doing the verbal cues when you're kind of saying like, like that's actually kind of annoying to listen to. I feel like you're very good at doing that. And then compensating by having very big facial movements. So like responding. But even when you're on the radio, say you're live on the radio, and so you're doing this interview, so you're having to think about the interview, you're having to listen to the answer so that you can respond to it, but you're also having to think about what is the next record I'm playing, what time is it, do I need to go into an ad break, do I need to plug anything before I get into the next, all of these things. And so often the comedian's just chatting away and you have to, whoever you're interviewing, so you have to shut them up. And so one of the things I learned is to do visual I'm about to talk now cues, which is just a kind of like going, or like maybe, but without sound, and then maybe lifting a finger, half a finger, you know, just like, and then that gets the person to stop talking without you having to clunkily interrupt them.
Interesting. That's something I'm going to remember.
That's another part.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've used the drawing in breath. I found that to be quite effective.
Mm-hmm. But then also maintaining eye contact.
Like, yeah, absolutely.
Having intense eye contact the whole time to show that you're listening, even if they don't hold that eye contact.
Around listening, and if I look at presentations, again, just kind of drawing myself back into the tech world for a moment, is techies in general like to show people that they know all the information that they know. So if you're doing a presentation about a certain topic, techies have a tendency just to, I need to explain everything that I know on this topic to make myself look super smart. And whilst someone's doing that, another character in the room is then potentially looking for potholes in what that person's saying. So that there's a different mode of listening, as in it's a, I am listening to everything that person's saying and reading the body language because I'm trying to find an area of weakness, something that I can kind of strike at.
Do you think they do that to make themselves look smart?
Yeah. I think there's a couple of elements to it. There's sometimes it's with the right intentions, where it is about kind of breaking something to see if, you know, is there a flaw in this thing that we can kind of develop and work on together. And that's what I hope, or I think that I try and do, is I do look for those potholes, but then at an aim to try and fill those potholes, or at least help to fill those potholes. So it is two different personalities. So it's one that's doing it for the great good, and then there's the one that just wants to show people that, hey, I'm smarter than him. He's kind of got that bit wrong. And there is that mode of listening as well, where it's kind of just finding those gaps.
But that's essential, right? In some situations, as you said, that like if you've got to find the potholes because you've got to fix them, I would much rather, like whenever I do a presentation, I always practice it. I always, you know, just go on Facebook and be like, who can come be a guinea pig? Because I want to make sure, because I don't know, I can make a kind of educated guess, but I don't know actually if things are landing or not.
No.
And so I think it's so, and so when I'm doing those test presentations, that's how I want people to be listening. I want them to be looking out for all the possible potholes.
I want to pick up on something that you mentioned earlier about your Russian background. And one of the things that has always intrigued me is diversity of storytelling based on cultures. So I'm not sure if I mentioned this to you before when we spoke, but so I'm from a Punjabi family. So Punjab is a state in northern India. And I, in kind of preparation for our conversation, I was just trying to reflect on what are the components of Punjabi storytelling in that narrative that is different to Western storytelling. And so quite a few things started to pop into my head, which I thought were rather entertaining and maybe interesting to explore with you. And if I was to phone my mom and ask her, what are you doing right now? I don't get an answer to that question. Instead, what I get is a whole load of context and a story with loads of plots and subplots and all these characters that start appearing. And then halfway through, half an hour through the conversation, I don't really get an answer for what she's doing, but I get this amazing story. And that is one of the areas that I've noticed around Punjabi storytelling is you don't just go straight from A to B. There is a whole load of diversion in the process until you get to that end point. And by the time you get to the end point, you've kind of forgotten what you'd asked anyway, so it's largely irrelevant. But what are the similarities in, I guess, that narrative, if any at all, to Russian storytelling?
I have the same experience where I call my mum and I say, how's it, you know, she doesn't say, how's Toronto, darling? She says, so there I am in the Gare du Nord in Paris. My train is leaving in 2 minutes and I pick up my suitcase and hair across the platform. You know, it's all very high drama all the time. Sometimes I'll call her. So I live in Toronto, Canada, and she's still in London. And I miss that. I love living here so much. I have a tattoo of the CN Tower on my ankle, like I'm here for life. But I miss my mum every day. And so I will call her even if I just have 2 minutes going from A to B. And she'll be like, let me tell you what's been happening in, you know, in Venezuela. The president has been blah, blah. And I'll be like, ma, I gotta go. But she just is desperate to tell stories all the time about everything. And so I think it's a similar thing in terms of like, there is no just straightforward conversation. It's just stories. I think most of the Russian stories I know are rude jokes. Mm. You know, they end up with someone, they involve a stupid person. And they end up with someone looking stupid. I lived in Russia till I was 2, and then I moved to the UK and I learned Russian at school. And I went back out there when I was 18 to live for just a few months. And I remember a week or two in being like, oh, I have this deep rooted belief that has been drilled into me by all the immigrants I grew up with, think that Russia is a stupid country and all Russians are idiots. And I had to like unlearn that because I was like, oh, wait, that's not a fact, because I was just surrounded by Russian immigrants and those were all the stories they told me the whole time. It's always a joke and somebody is always the butt of it. But actually, in terms of like the ways that day-to-day stories are told, I think it's just very involved and lots of, you know, lots of drama and lots of detail and lots of emotion.
See, the drama and the emotion is something quite similar as well, because a lot of Punjabi stories are based around tragedy or things that you should fear. And never really understood why. But one of the areas that I kind of drew from this was around taboo topics. So there are, you know, Punjabi culture is very conservative in its nature. So there are some conversations that people just don't have. But those conversations do happen in stories. So love, sexuality, they're just not conversation topics. But there are 20 versions of Romeo and Juliet, as an example.
Interesting.
So that concept of we don't talk about these things, but we have stories about them instead. I've never really understood the dynamics of that.
That's interesting. I mean, storytelling was like how we passed down information before we had books. You know, I think in so many cultures, the storytelling is deeply embedded and we just have replaced it with facts. But I think it makes complete sense that you would put things into stories that you couldn't. I think it's often, you know, there are certain North American cultures where it's like that's how you teach children is through stories. Like that's how information is passed down. And I think that's what we used to do. We used to calm ourselves down by the fire and pass on information back in our Stone Age days.
I guess sitting around that fire is also those other vehicles of telling the stories, like music. And even food, to a degree, there's a story behind food. And when we, I guess, when you explore, when we spoke about vulnerability before as well. So again, one of the, and I don't want to stereotype Punjabis, but vulnerability isn't cool, you know, but that's largely attributed to, I guess, this notion of pride. So people don't like to have themselves cracked open either. And again, that vulnerability then starts to come through kind of stories, and as in stories from books or from music, from lyrics in music. So I find it interesting how certain cultures have, where things aren't acceptable to talk about them, they just find another vehicle to kind of push those messages.
That's really interesting, and it makes sense, you know, that it would come out somewhere.
Absolutely. And obviously alcohol also helps as well.
There's a lot of that in Russia.
I thought there might be a commonality there.
Yes.
So using myself and yourself as an example, so we have this diversity of multiple cultural backgrounds. Do you think that gives us an advantage when it comes to storytelling?
Yeah. It just feels like kind of an advantage when it comes to life, really, to have different perspectives. I mean, for me in my job, I've been doing this for nearly 8 years, which, side note, I cannot believe my luck. My mum, I asked her once, what do you tell people when they ask what I do? Especially in the UK where like coaching isn't really a thing. You know, now I'm doing a bit more consulting, whatever it is I do with companies. But everybody in the UK thinks I'm a life coach. And I'm like, I'm not a life coach. But I feel like that's like being like, he's a cheese farmer. No, he's a dairy farmer. Like, if you don't know, it's same. Anyway, when I ask my mum what she says, I say to people, Marsha has knit herself a career out of thin air. But just hearing all these different stories, I feel like it gives me an understanding. I mean, a bit like I was talking earlier, because my brain thinks the stories have happened to me, I'm never going to know what it's like to be racially discriminated against at work. But I now have a better understanding of what that experience is like because I managed to find emotional ways to connect with that. You know, I know a lot more about stopping drinking when you've been an alcoholic for 10 years or going to prison when you're not supposed to be, when you've been accused of something you didn't do, or going and protesting at Standing Rock in North Dakota, or all of these things. Now I kind of get a bit of what that's like. And so now when I come to another storyteller or a client, I can draw on that. So I can be like, oh, is it a bit like this? Or, you know, in terms of helping them pull out that story and helping them articulate that story, I have some understanding. Whereas if you just are in your own little small world and you don't know about anything, but I don't think that you have to be from those cultures to get that cultural diversity. But I think it is important. And that's something that I didn't think about for years and years. I just read, I found recently a list I'd made maybe, I don't know, 6 years ago about the 11 best gigs I'd ever been to. And one was Regina Spektor, and all the other 10 were white, straight, non-disabled men, like all of them in the whole band of singers. And I was like, oh, yeah, because I just used to kind of mostly consume the media and the cultural, you know, the books and the movies and the stories that were presented to me easily. And I didn't think about seeking out more diverse voices, you know. And I think in what I've been referring to as the great waking up of 2020, there are many of us who have been trying to do a better job of that. And I, over the last few years, have been trying to be like, okay, which book am I going to read? And can I maybe choose one from a voice that isn't as easily heard? But I think that's what makes us better storytellers and presenters and peoples is just by trying to consume more points of view. And I guess, you know, again, that's storytelling, if it's music or books or movies or whatever, so that we aren't going into situations being like, what was wrong with that? You know, so that we can have some understanding, like learning about microaggressions. That was the thing I never knew about 10 years ago. And I would have done the white person thing of being like, what? They didn't mean anything by it. There's nothing wrong with that. And now it's like, oh, okay. Yeah. Now I understand it. And I see the built up, and I have, you know, I've kind of ingested enough, whether it's speaking to storytellers or reading books or watching movies or listening to podcasts, I've like ingested enough information to have some understanding of what that experience is like, to know that it's not okay, and then to try and notice it and call it out or call it in.
Absolutely. I think it is. It's just being open to that diversity, I think, and just being able to kind of inhale it and consume it is something just be advantageous to everybody.
And even just seeing it, you know, for the first, whatever, 35 years of my life, I didn't even know that I wasn't, you know, I just was like doing things. I wasn't being like, oh, I'm only going to listen to white people. That's all I listen to. But it just never crossed my mind, you know, because again, I'm moving through my privileged little bubble. And so I think it's like waking up to like, oh, I should actually try and, you know, consume things, not just by this one very small demographic, like whatever dominant demographic. And then being open to being influenced by it as well.
And also the important thing about that is it helps people then draw commonalities, things that people can relate to. Because one of the things that I found really effective as well is I've always been fascinated with different cultures, different religions, different backgrounds. It's just something that I've just naturally just been curious about. But I've also realized how effective it can be in drawing connections as well. So one of the things that I've kind of always subconsciously done is be more aware of kind of understanding what somebody's background might be. And one thing I realized is, and this is where I think the whole movement around Black Lives Matter is important, is the ability to talk up and just to have these conversations. And it's only taken me a few years, Masha, to actually be comfortable in having these types of conversations where I'm happy to talk about my own background. And I also want to draw that out from other people as well. And, you know, I guess, like you say, if you open your spectrum to the things that you're listening to, that you're reading, that you're consuming, when it comes to making connections, it helps to then find a commonality, something that you think, you know, that I'm going to assume that that's the culture that person is from. And I know something that I can bring into a conversation that helps build a connection.
Mm-hmm. And knowing the right questions. Mm. So I read a book a couple of months ago of essays called Black is the Body by Emily Bernard. Wonderful. Oh my God, I just felt like I was being hugged by the book the whole time. And she talks in it, there's a whole chapter about hair, about her hair and her daughter's hair, and she and her daughters are both black. And then... and I sort of, you know, I was like, I know that black hair on ladies, like I know there's some things about that, but I didn't really, but reading that essay, I felt like I had a much more profound understanding of the very, very different relationship that black women have with their hair than I have with my hair. And then I had a storyteller who came to my show whose story essentially was about her relationship with her hair. And so it meant that when I was there in the role of like, you know, story coach, story like extractor and shaper, I was a bit more of a safe pair of hands than I would have been 3 months before I'd read Emily Bernard's book, because I had some understanding and I could sort of notice questions to ask and notice little cracks that I could peer into, and also know which questions not to ask, and also like understand the horror, you know, when she's describing, as she does in the show, she talks about working in a corporate job and one of the vice presidents saying, oh, can I touch your hair? And she's just like, I actually just need to get something out of this woman right now. I need to sign this piece of paper. And so she bends over and then is just like, has her hair rubbed. All this woman's yelling out to her colleagues going, oh, it's much softer than you'd think. It's like horrendous. But I feel like even that, I had a much better understanding of the questions to pull that element of the story out, and then the, you know, the appropriate responses. And anyway, and so I think, yeah, it helps us so much, and I'm so grateful to everybody for making the art and writing the books and making the movies.
Well, it just helps us to be more present in knowing what is what is appropriate and what is not appropriate, you know. And I think just that self-awareness is often prejudices are just born out from a lack of self-awareness, just not knowing what is right or wrong, as opposed to purposely going out of somebody's way to express a negative opinion.
Yeah. Oh God. I think that's most racism, is that too.
Yeah. And so, yeah, your point around, you know, inhaling, consuming diverse content and I think having those diverse experiences from our own background, just be able to leverage that, I think is immensely powerful. This is probably a really good point, which, Marsha, we aim to wrap up today's conversation. And I really enjoyed cycling through various topic areas. I don't think there's anything that we haven't bounced through. So it's been good to actually cover such a wide spectrum. We've covered a lot of terrain in today's conversation. And in thinking about how I close down the episode with you, is when I think about storytelling, one of the things that is important to me, because it's important to my daughter, is she is a keen, avid writer. And we're often telling her to write her own story. We're often kind of seeking other stories to write, other things to find, things to cling on to. And I think there's a huge value in us just being able to write our own story. What are the things that happen to us? You know, what are the things that we experience? What are we learning from something? But in the same time, almost feel a little bit conflicted at the moment, where I think the architect to our stories is starting to become other things like social media. I think a lot of those influences is starting to have an impact on how youngsters are documenting their story or even thinking about their story. You know, if we often talk about journaling is a means of us writing our history as it happens. But do you have any thoughts for youngsters that are either documenting their story right now through journaling, or what can they use for that story just not to be negatively influenced, so it can be authentic, they can be allowed to be vulnerable, feel safe to be vulnerable, and just have something that they can recall back on?
I think with any storytelling, it's about the moments. It's about describing those action scenes. It's about answering the question, what did it look like and how did you feel, over and over again. Like, I think when the story is badly told, it's when it's all commentary. You know, I really feel that people in general do X, Y, Z, you know. Or when people say, you feel this and you do this, and I'm always with my storytellers being like, can I lovingly invite you to use the word I, because I was not there, you know. And I think when I look back on stories, like, the things that I want to record are the moments. Like, when we remember our childhood, we don't tend to remember, like, the narrative, big picture. Mm. We remember the little moments. We remember sitting in the garden with our friend Monica from up the street with, you know, the little chicks that we'd bought from the store. Or we remember being in the kitchen with our granny up at the stove, whatever it is. And so I think those are like the things that I most want to capture for myself. And even I have a plan to start interviewing with my mum, because we always said we would sit my granny down. My granny, like, fled the Bolsheviks when she was five, moved to Turkey, had this really amazing life, and we never did, and then she died. And so I said to my mum just last week, I was like, Ma, we have to do this. But I think it's going to be really about pulling out the moments and pulling out, like, describe those little scenes, so that we can get a sense of, you know, that's often what you're doing in storytelling, is you're just giving people a sense of what life was like at that moment. And so I think when you're doing that, as long as you're not being like, everything's perfect and nothing was, you know, I didn't feel bad at any moment, really, that it's just describing. Brené Brown, to bring her up again, says storytelling is data with soul. And I think, yes, and it's also data with data. It's just the other bit of data is, how did you feel? How did you feel? How did you feel? As long as you include the emotion, then it's going to be engaging. And so I think it's like, focus on the moment, describe a moment, then describe another moment, then describe another moment. That's what I think all the best stories are.
Marcia, thank you so much.
That was super fun.
For your time today. I really enjoyed everything we've covered. And like I said before, we've covered so much terrain in this conversation. It's just been incredible. So thanks again for your time. And I welcome you back at some point, any point in the future, for a follow-up conversation.
Thank you. I'd love to. That was super fun.
And to my audience, as always, thank you so much for listening. I'll put more information about Marcia, a link to the Secret webpage, and any resources in or around any of the topics of conversation that we've covered today. I will punch all that information into the show notes of today's episode. Now, if you've enjoyed the episode, don't forget to hit that subscribe button and rate and review the show on whatever podcast merchant delivers this podcast to your device or your computer. And sign up to the mailing list. Link is in the show notes. If you feel inspired by this conversation, then have this conversation with friends and colleagues. Tell your stories. Because when we open ourselves up to being vulnerable, that's when people really connect with us. When we show our emotions. When we're willing to share these tangential stories that might feel irrelevant. The relevance is that those stories tell more about us than anything else. That's what creates the spark of human attraction. So this is me closing down another incredible episode of the Bobby Jagdeo podcast. Again, thank you so much for listening. Till next time.